From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Groups that push for new occupational licenses act as bottleneckers, harming the economy and limiting innovation. That's the contention in a recent book on the topic. You'll hear from the author. A March primary might become a permanent part of North Carolina's election calendar in the future. You'll learn why. Amid all the partisan bickering in Raleigh, state lawmakers have reached bipartisan agreement on some issues, among them a series of bills designed to improve relations between local law enforcement agencies and the communities they serve. Plus, a new study suggests North Carolina's economy benefits when people get sick. You'll hear from a critic. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina's new general fund budget not only lays out the spending plan for the year that starts July 1st, it also contains a provision to study how North Carolina funds public education. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research. He's also the Director of Education Studies. He's been taking a look at this provision quite closely and is here to help us understand exactly what it means. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
First of all, why study how we fund public education?
Well, studying it is actually a good step because in the past we have just allowed our current funding system to go on year after year. We really do need to step back and ask ourselves whether the way we're funding public schools in North Carolina makes any sense, because a study done by the legislative staff told us that there are some issues with the way that we fund our public schools. It's not very transparent. It's hard to follow. There are only a handful of people in the state that actually can understand how we fund our public schools, so that maybe we should take a look at it. It's an extremely complex system we have in North Carolina of doling out billions and billions of state dollars.
Have we been doing it the same way for a long time?
We have, and we unfortunately have been content with the way that we've been funding our public schools, and we do so by basically having dozens of little pots of money earmarked for different things. So there's an allotment for books, there's an allotment for teachers, there's allotment for any number of different things that we spend money on in our public schools. And the money's really hard to follow. And we're talking mainly about state dollars, because the federal dollars that we get are pretty closely defined in how we are supposed to spend those dollars. And local funds are extremely flexible, so localities can earmark the money for any number of different things. So we're talking about the way we spend state dollars. And we've had this complicated system for decades. And now the legislature is finally getting around to seeing if there's a better way of doing this.
You just said something that some folks might be scratching their heads and saying, I didn't even realize that. A lot of people think that it's the state of North Carolina that funds public education. Some people may think, well, you know, I hear that's why I'm paying more property taxes to my city and or my county, because they say we have to pay for education. There's really three levels of government involved in funding education.
That's right. And the state government is the largest. And in fact, of all the 50 states, we're in that top percentile, or not the top percentile, but the top group of states with regard to the amount of state funding we give to our public schools. So around 65% of our state funding comes from the state, with another 25% from localities and another 10% from the federal government. So if you look at the percentage that the state contributes to our public schools, we have one of the highest in the nation. So that is the one thing to remember. And a lot of other states fund their public schools with local property taxes. We fund are most from the state. And because the state provides so much of the funding, they really get to set the rules. And in this case, they set the rules on how the money gets divided up between districts, because that's really what we're talking about. So the state legislature says we are going to set aside X amount of money, say $8 billion for our public schools. We want it in general to go to these things, but it's the Department of Public Instruction that really determines how that money and how much of that money goes to each of our school districts and how it's distributed to those districts. And right now we have a very district-centered way of funding our public schools. We would like to see it, and we've been at John Locke Foundation has been advocating this for several years. We want to see a more student-based funding system. So right now we have a very district-based. Everything is based on the school district and the schools in that district.
So, Terry, the legislature has now set up this study group that's going to take a look at all this. It sounds really complex, even just from the different things that you're describing. So where do they start? When they all sit down at that first meeting, what are they going to say, here's what we're going to do?
Well, I hope they start by looking at the current system. They need to acquaint themselves with how the current system works, because that will tell them all they need to know about the necessity to change it. Because there are some folks that don't believe that we need to change the way we fund our public schools. They like it just fine. And some, frankly, don't care about the issue that it's not very transparent, that it's not easy to find where dollar A starts and ends. So that's not a concern. So they first have to make sure that they understand the current system, and then they have to see what alternatives are out there. And you look at a lot of the alternative systems. Some of them have a variation of the way that we fund schools now, and some are a radical departure to the way we fund our public schools now. And I think that's the direction we need to go in.
Tell us a little bit more about that. You're saying it would be a radical departure. What would be different under the plan that Dr. Terry Stoops would put forth?
Well, instead of thinking about funding teachers and funding school district personnel and funding books, the funding would be attached to the student as something called a weighted student funding system. With basically what we do is we say, okay, every student in the state, we will attach $5,000 to that student. And if that student has a special need, we will attach an additional amount of money. If they come from a low-income school, we'll attach an additional amount of money. So that if you have a student from a low-income family that is has a special need, that student would have, say, $9,000 attached to them rather than the base of $5,000. So it would really be attentive to individual student needs and not just pots of money that are given to a school district. Now, my hope is that by attaching it to the student, thinking about funding in a student way, we start to think to ourselves, well, if we're attaching funding to the student, maybe the student or parent should have a say in where that money goes.
And what you just said there, that's usually where the rub comes into the story.
Yes.
When we talk about making any sort of change to how things work. Is that going to be one of the issues that this study group looks at, potentially really changing having the money follow the student versus just going directly into a system?
That's right. And that's really down the road. I mean, we're not going to get to that system anytime soon. It's going to be implemented and considered over many years, because the one thing we have to remember is if we change the way we fund our public schools, there may be winners and losers. Some districts receive an extraordinary amount of money right now, and maybe under a revised system they wouldn't. So legislators have to be very careful here to ensure that there aren't huge winners and huge losers, but instead we start and perhaps slowly move to a system where we change the way we fund schools, but not to the detriment of certain districts and not to the benefit of others.
Any sense of how long it will take this study group to take a look at all of these issues? And presumably they're going to have to put together some sort of a report and recommendations to submit to the legislature?
I think they can look at the different systems very quickly and easily over the course of a few months. There are only a limited number of options out there. The real question becomes implementation. Once they choose or select one type of funding system to go to, it may take several years for that to come into fully effect.
And no doubt lots of folks will want to weigh in on what those recommendations turn out to be. We'll have you back to talk about that. We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. When business owners call for government to increase regulation of their own industry, they're just looking out for their customers, right? Well, not necessarily. A new book labels these business owners bottleneckers. And here to explain why is the book's co-author. Dick Carpenter is Director of Strategic Research at the Institute for Justice and a professor at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We're going to get into this topic of bottleneckers and what they do. But first of all, let's just define, what is a bottlenecker?
Yeah, so we define it as somebody who advocates for the creation or perpetuation of an economic regulation, particularly an occupational license, in order to restrict free flow of workers into an occupation and enjoy an economic benefit as a result.
So basically, this would be a business that says, government, come in and regulate us. We want you to.
Yes, I know. At first blush, it sounds crazy. Who would ask for government regulation or government intrusion in their business? But people come to realize that if they can actually keep competitors out through what we call a bottleneck, then they're able to artificially inflate prices and wages as a result.
Now, you mentioned those results, that you can inflate the wages, inflate the prices. But I think a lot of people hearing this off the top of their head would say, oh, this is good. These businesses realize that they need to have government step in and help and make sure that customers are going to be protected. Do you have a hard time convincing some people that this is not good? These people aren't doing this just to benefit the customers. It's to benefit themselves.
Yeah. So on the surface, it does seem like that's what's going on. That's, in fact, when people ask for a license in their industry, because that's how the licenses come into existence. People in the industry ask for a license. The impression is that we're going to protect the public because we're going to ensure that people have a certain level of knowledge and experience. But in fact, the research that has looked at this shows that there is no benefit in the terms of a greater quality of service or greater protection for the public, that the real result is this increase to consumers, increase in terms of prices that consumers will pay, but also fewer job opportunities, because this is one of the rare public policies that does what it's designed to do. It actually keeps people out. That's what it's designed to do. So it keeps people out of the industry. So it reduces employment opportunities as well. So it's a policy with a whole lot of cost and not much benefit.
The term bottleneckers I have not heard before in regards to this, but I have heard this situation described in the past as operating almost like a medieval guild in mm-hmm. some respects. Is it similar to what we saw centuries ago when guilds decided, yes, you can work with us, or no, you can't?
That's exactly right. Precisely. It operates very much like a guild. So recall that years ago in a guild system, people who were in the particular industry that wanted protection, they would band together. They would then go to whatever their city government was, and they would ask for a certain type of protection. so that they could keep people out and regulate who could come in. And so the government, whatever the particular form of government they had, city government, would grant them that exclusive right to practice. And so an occupational license works very much the same way, where the government gives the industry a certain type of protection, and then those who are in the industry have the ability to regulate who comes in as a result of this government power that they're now given.
That is the voice of Dick Carpenter. He is director of strategic research at the Institute for Justice, also a professor at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. And he is co-author of this book titled Bottleneckers, Gaming the Government for Power and Private Profit. Within the book itself, I'm guessing that you're documenting a number of cases in which this plays out. What are some of the most egregious examples?
Right. So each chapter looks at a different occupation. So we start with the alcohol industry in the three-tier system. And then we do cosmetologists, and we talk a little bit about barbers, but mostly focus on cosmetologists and how cosmetologists use their laws to exclude hair braiders, to prevent hair braiders from practicing their particular craft. We talk about interior designers. Believe it or not, to work as an interior designer in three states in the District of Columbia, you have to have a license. And to earn that license to become an interior designer, you have to have 6 years of education or experience.
Six years.
It's one of the most severe licenses out there. 6 years of education experience. You have to pass a national examination that is offered only by the Interior Design Association, of course. So that's one of the occupations that we take on in the book. We also talk about street vendors. So this has become a very popular occupation and a popular way for people to buy food, for instance, but not exclusively food. But street vending is as old as America. It goes back centuries. And now in many cities, in a growing number of cities, one has to be licensed in order to work as a street vendor. So we talk about street vendors. We also talk about probably one of the more pernicious out there, and that is the regulation of the transportation industry, particularly taxis and limousines, which is, of course, seen a lot of upheaval now with Uber and Lyft and ride sharing. But the regulation of transportation goes back many, many years. So we talk about the transportation industry. And now we have seen how bottleneckers have attempted to regulate the mere act of speaking. So we talk about a case that involves a gentleman here in North Carolina who had a blog. He wanted to share his experience about being on the paleo diet and how it improved his life, his health. So he wrote a blog to talk about that, and the North Carolina Board of Dietitians actually said, you have to censor your blog or else they would bring the hammer down. He was just talking. He wasn't even making a living from his blog, but it didn't matter. They wanted to make sure that no one could give advice. Even though there are millions of diet books, people all over the place have newspaper columns, and they're on the radio talking about diet and health. But they wanted to make sure that there was no threat to anyone in their industry as a result of somebody giving out free advice. And that was Steve Cooksey. And so we took that particular case as well.
A lot of people will hear this, I think, and say to themselves, yeah, I can understand that in these egregious cases, there shouldn't be licensing. But in other cases, what's the alternative? Because if you got rid of the licenses, wouldn't all these bad actors be able to go out there and scam people? So are there good alternatives to this licensing regime?
Yes, there are many good alternatives, not least of which are actually market alternatives. So when people think there's no government regulation, they seem to think there's no regulation at all. But in fact, there is a form of regulation. It's market regulation. The behavior of individuals in an industry is, in fact, regulated. It's regulated by the pressure that's brought to bear as a result of consumer decisions. So if I'm not maintaining a certain level of quality of service in my business, consumers are going to stay away, and as a result, my bottom line suffers. And so my behavior, my services are regulated, if you will, by these market forces, these market pressures. But now on our phones, we have the ability to, even more so today than at any time in history, we have the ability to regulate the behavior of individuals by the reputation that one has. And so consumers can actually go online and fill out give ratings or put their experience in writing and make it available for everyone else to see. And that also applies pressure on people who provide goods and services as well. So there are market forces out there that regulate the way people provide goods and services. But then there are government forms of regulation that are not licensing, but have some of the same benefits.
The book Bottleneckers, Gaming the Government for Power and Private Profit. The co-author is Dick Carpenter, Director of Strategic Research at the Institute for Justice, also a professor at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina moved its primary election forward from May to March for the 2016 presidential race. Now, a March primary could become a permanent part of the state's election calendar. Republican State Representative Burt Jones recently touted a bill to move primary elections.
Currently, they are in May, except if you read the strike-throughs there that when South Carolina holds its presidential primaries after the 15th of March, the North Carolina primary moves. And so what this bill would do would be to establish a certain date in March for the North Carolina primaries for everyone. There would be one primary for the presidential primary and everyone else as well. So it would be the Tuesday after the first Monday in March.
House Democratic leader Darren Jackson objected to the change. He reminded colleagues that surrounding states have later primaries for legislative elections.
We all know that moving the primary from May to March is going to make for a much longer general election campaign. It will be good for people in the industry, the media, the consultants, not so great for the candidates, and it actually means that we having session in May, you know, will be really heated up, and I just think that's going to be an issue. You know, moving the filing deadline to December is really an incumbent protection idea, and of course it protects me just like it protects everyone else in this House as incumbents. It's not a partisan issue, but it does conflict with Christmas and Hanukkah, and really the one time a year that's nonpartisan in this country is December. It's kind of the time of year we get away from partisan politics for the most part.
Jones reminded colleagues about the original reason for a March primary, to play a more important role in the presidential race.
I think if you look historically, the states that have gone earlier have been more influential. You can always look back and you can find one or two exceptions to the rule. But as the ninth largest state in the country, and the fact that our neighbor South Carolina, for instance, is going very early, I think it does make sense to have our presidential primary a bit earlier. The filing date in this case would be sometime between Thanksgiving, which is in November, and Christmas, which is at the end of December. And personally, I just don't think that regardless when the filing date is, that it necessarily favors one person over another, one party over another, the incumbent, the challenger. I don't really see that. I think it is good for our citizens that we establish a date certain.
You've been listening to debate about the General Assembly's plan to move North Carolina primary elections permanently to March. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Amid all the partisan fights in the North Carolina General Assembly, some issues attract a good deal of bipartisan support. One of them, improving relationships between local law enforcement agencies and the communities they serve. Democratic State Representative Ed Haynes recently discussed legislative efforts to improve those relationships.
We began that process during the last biennium with a $5 million budget provision for body cameras, as well as taking the first steps toward establishing a statewide guidelines regarding video taken from those body cameras. We continued this commitment with the League of Municipalities last year when we held a meeting of law enforcement officers and civic leaders in Raleigh to discuss what could be done to enhance opportunities for better engagement with police officers and the community across the state. Last October, Representative Craig Horn and I had a serious conversation about what we could do collectively to move this process forward. We decided to engage a number of Republican and Democratic leaders in the House and Senate to discuss ideas regarding legislation that could make a difference for law enforcement and the community. Surprise, surprise, we got back into session and people got busy on their individual process and products and projects, but a funny thing happened. Many of the people who we initially engaged with in October ran some great legislation aimed at improving protections for law enforcement, aimed at making our citizens safer and their engagement with law enforcement safer, and even providing fair outcomes when law enforcement and the judiciary, as happens in every profession on earth, happens to get it wrong.
Haynes ticked off a list of bills in 2017 that tackled similar themes.
House Bill 21 was run by Representative Ken Goodman, Faircloth, McNeil, and Earl, and on the Senate side by Senators McKissick, Daniel, and Britt. And this was an act to require driver instruction on law enforcement and procedures during traffic stops. We also had another somewhat related bill, House Bill 84, run by Representative Insko and Representative Ball. And that bill dealt with deaf and hard of hearing designations being put on driver's licenses. These are two of the bills that are really game changers and culture changers with regard to police and community relations in the state of North Carolina.
Haynes mentioned other bills tackling similar topics.
We also had House Bill 571, which was myself and Representative Dobson and Hardister and Quick, which was an act to provide for automatic expunction of a person's record if the person is wrongfully convicted, incarcerated, and then exonerated. And, of course, this speaks to things that we understand. Our justice system is not perfect. None of us are. But when we make these mistakes and these people have been exonerated by the state, their arrest records ought to be cleared as well. Also, House Bill 591, which is a bill run by Representative Charles Graham, which is an act directing the Department of Justice and Public Safety to study training that may be provided to law enforcement officers to improve the officer's ability during a traffic stop to identify whether a person is deaf or hard of hearing or has a developmental disability or traumatic brain injury.
That's Democratic State Representative Ed Haynes highlighting recent efforts to help improve relationships between law enforcement agencies and the communities they serve. Joining Haynes for a recent news conference were other legislators who've worked on these issues. Democratic Senator Floyd McKissick helped sponsor the bill that would help new drivers learn the best way to handle a traffic stop.
We know and we understand that when young drivers are learning to drive, they also need to learn and understand what's appropriate protocol and appropriate procedures when they're detained or stopped by a law enforcement officer. Unfortunately, a young driver may engage in what they consider to be innocent conduct in reaching underneath their seat or reaching for the glove compartment or getting out of their vehicles. At the same time, that law enforcement officer is perceiving that same activity as a potential threat. We need to make certain that our drivers know and understand what appropriate protocol is, what process they should follow. Perhaps getting their hands on that steering wheel or on that dashboard, not engaging in activity that could be considered threatening, that could escalate to an encounter, something that could avoid a tragic outcome. That's what we're concerned about, and doing it proactively before these incidences occur.
Republican Representative John Faircloth is a former city police chief. He's been working on these issues as well.
I have seen over the past 3 or 4 years here more and more cooperation between the Senate and the House, between the individual members in the Senate and in the House, and the citizens who are interested in the headlines they're seeing that speak to problems in our society about relationships between citizens and police officers. Last session, after about 2 years' work, we put together the bill having to do with police cameras. That's still a product that's being worked on. There's an addition to that bill we're working on this time, and there will be some minor additions to that. That's a work in progress, because every time a citizen meets a police officer, one or the other or both could be at a moment of stress. And that's where we see problems that Senator McKissick was talking about that we need to try to address in terms of knowledge for young people. What do you do when an officer stops you? And in terms of how do you de-escalate a situation when you see that the other party is having a problem, is having some trauma, is scared, if you will. So I am so proud to be a part of this this bill this time, which speaks to having education to young drivers to have them know what they should be doing when that blue light goes on behind them.
Democratic Representative Cynthia Ball has helped lead the effort to add information about deaf and hearing-impaired drivers on driver's licenses.
One of the things that prompted this bill was the tragedy in Charlotte when a young person was shot by an officer not understanding that he was hearing-impaired. This bill puts on the actual record of the person's driver's license electronically as well as printed on the actual driver's license a symbol that designates that the person is hearing impaired. And it also is in the electronic record of the tag of the car that that person is driving. We believe that that allows the law enforcement officer to have some advance notice of the individual who he is approaching and be prepared to recognize that person as hearing impaired or deaf. And we believe that that protects our law enforcement as well as our vulnerable citizens who are hearing impaired.
Representative Amos Quick added his voice to the conversation.
I think all of us on both sides of the aisle are interested in perfecting our experiences when we have law enforcement or systems like criminal justice systems, that they are achieving their purpose, but also are fair to the people who encounter law enforcement or who encounter our criminal justice system. So it was a delight for me to be able to be a part of some of these bills, be it body cam bills or be it expungement bills, that seek to do what we all want to do in this country, and that is to perfect our union so that we have the best system on the world like we currently have, but have opportunities to improve that system when we see opportunities to do so.
Senator Paul Lowe explained why he's supporting these measures.
We've got to make things better. And to make things better and to build upon what is happening, we have to look at ways of having good relationships. For good relationships make for better communities, make for safer communities.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent news conference touting a series of bipartisan bills. Each fits with the general theme of improving relationships between North Carolina law enforcement agencies and the communities they serve. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Flawed economics, that is the conclusion of the John Locke Foundation's senior economist, Dr. Roy Cordato, after he analyzed a report that concludes North Carolina's hospitals and healthcare systems boost the state's economy. Dr. Cordato joins us now to explain why getting sick really isn't that big boost that some people say it is. Roy, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be back, Donna.
Tell us why you decided to write about this issue, healthcare economics, essentially.
Well, when you look at this study, I was glancing at it and I realized what they were telling us beyond initially what they're saying, which is, well, you know, hospitals spend this money and invest in equipment and doctors and nurses and so on. And therefore, that money ripples through the economy, increases GDP. What is unstated is what initially generates that spending is people getting sick.
Which right? We usually don't want to happen to people.
That's right. The idea, if you think about their study carefully, they say this spending on the part of hospitals boosts the economy. But what boosts that spending on the part of the economy? Well, people getting sick and needing medical treatment. And the implication of the study is the more people are sick, the more costs there are associated with them, hospital costs in particular, and therefore the better it is for the economy. And that's crazy. And the problem is that they don't consider the fact that people would be spending this money otherwise if they weren't getting sick. And the real benefit of this government spending, or I'm sorry, of this hospital spending, isn't that they're hiring more doctors and nurses. That's a cost. The benefit is, and they'll talk about this at all, is, okay, well, there are benefits, lives saved, medical conditions avoided, and so on. But they don't even discuss any of those, which are the true benefits of that spending.
Roy, how would an industry come up with a conclusion like this? So you really got deep into the analysis of how they went about determining what is a cost and what is a benefit.
Yes.
Talk to us about that.
Well, it's very slippery. This study is very slippery because they start out by saying, well, we're going to look at all these hospital expenditures on capital equipment, on doctors, nurses, and so on. And they never identify them as costs. But the fact is that all these things are healthcare costs. And if you look in the literature, no one views increased healthcare costs as a good thing. They all see it as a burden on economic growth, and it's a thing to be minimized. And it's something that we've devoted a lot of policy, both state and federal, to try to minimize those costs, right? But they never call them costs. First, they call them expenditures. And then in the study, they say, this is actually a benefits analysis. So they suddenly start calling them benefits. Avoiding the whole notion that really what they're talking about is added healthcare costs essentially being good for the economy, which flies in the face of all economic analysis of healthcare costs.
Why would someone produce a report like this?
Well, it's special interest. I mean, this was put out by the North Carolina Hospital Association. They are a trade association that wants everyone to think that you know what they do has this great benefit for the economy, and it's the study is done by a Research Triangle Institute, which is paid for by North Carolina Hospital Association. So they're basically being paid to give a result that the Hospital Association wants to see, and they use an economic impact model called IMPLAN, which is really designed to show how great an impact a particular industry is having. There's no such thing within the context of that model of actually any industry having a negative impact. And I've written about that elsewhere.
And interesting that you point out economics aside, I don't think there's anyone listening to our voices that would disagree that the positive impact of hospitals and doctors and nurses and radiologists and cancer specialists is that they're saving lives.
They're saving lives. And of course, there are benefits. But the fact is that everything they identify is the cost of generating that benefits. They are not the benefits. Really, these healthcare costs are not adding to GDP. They're absorbing GDP. They're not adding to jobs. They are actually absorbing part of the labor force to do these things. If that part of the GDP was liberated to do other things by either reducing healthcare costs, making it more efficient, or having, you know, fewer sick people, we'd all be better off. But I mean, there are crazy, if you think about the implications of this, it's really crazy. You know, if smoking causes more cancer, that means more people will go into hospitals. Hospitals will spend more, and that's going to increase GDP. I mean, that's actually if you think about the absurdity of this study, that's where it takes you.
Now, I have known you for a number of years, and I know that this happens to be what I would call one of your pet peeves.
No, absolutely.
Economic impact studies. So this is not the first time that you've taken a look at a study like this. And often, Roy, we see this sometimes at the local government level,
right,
where you will have a proposal on the table to say a county commissioners group that they want to use taxpayer money to build a hotel.
Yeah, hotel, a convention center, stadium. And you get the same kind of thing, right? They act like there's no cost. That what these things do are examine expenditures, and always assuming that if that money didn't go to whatever it is, the stadium or the convention center, it wasn't going to go in somewhere else. So they don't take into consideration the possibility that any of that money or the jobs or whatever would go elsewhere if it wasn't being channeled by the government expenditure into building whatever it is the project is.
Roy, some of this that you're describing is pretty fundamental economics.
So basic.
Why then is it that these types of economic impact studies, not just in North Carolina,
mm-hmm,
but
everywhere,
they exist everywhere,
right,
when you hear a proposal to build something or do something? What is it that folks like you can be doing? Is it just talking more about this to try to get people to understand what's
happening? Yeah, I think we do. We have to get legislators to understand, to look at these things very critically. Because, look, the real reason these things, a trade association or something puts a lot of money into these things is because they expect to affect legislation one way or another. And, you know, right now, for example, there's a certificate of need laws. Well, hospital association, that's, are very much against those. And they want to say, look, we are doing all these great things. You shouldn't do anything that hurts hospitals. Look how good this is for your economy. So what we want to do is try to make legislators especially understand that they need to look at these studies with a very, very critical eye and understand what they are saying and what they are not saying.
What about for those of us who are taxpayers? If you're living in a city or a county and you hear that there's a proposal to spend more tax dollars on building something, what could just an average taxpayer do? What should they know in order to perhaps go to that city council meeting and start asking questions?
Well, absolutely. I think what they should do is go to a city council meeting armed with our research.
at
johnlock.org. Seriously, I mean, we've done a lot on this. In the last few months, I've written several papers on this issue and say, hey, look, this was done, and here are the problems. Because, look, they all have the same problems. Kind of, no matter what the source, what the issue is, the models that they use have all the same problems. They're commercial models. They're meant to generate big numbers.
And the key is to make sure that costs as well as benefits are identified.
That's right. And costs are almost never identified. In fact, what they do is that they may identify costs, but then they call them benefits.
Dr. Roy Cordato has been writing about this. And, of course, you can find his analysis of this particular economic impact study at johnlock.org, along with all of his other writing. Roy Cordato, thanks so much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.